The following is a production of Alabama Public Radio News.
I guess the holy grail of what we don't know about the Battle of Mobile Bay is exactly what Farragut said when he ordered his flagship to go through the minefield.
Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead.
Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead.
Damn the torpedoes, full steam ahead.
Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead.
Low!
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 Fire!
Soldiers of Fort Morgan, your country has given this trust of honor in your charge. Their eyes are now directed here. Will you make them proud of you and fulfill their expectations?
A ship is sunk and goes down, yet the rest of them fight their way through and destroy the enemy flotilla and seize the bay. I mean, it's a dramatic story.
Alabamians can look to key historical events in our past that changed our state and left lasting implications. Iberville and Bienville founding Mobile in 1702, the March for Civil Rights in 1965. The Battle of Mobile Bay and Siege of Fort Morgan has unquestionably earned a place on any list of impactful moments in Alabama history.
I'm Jeremy Loeb, Alabama Public Radio News. 150 years ago, the Battle of Mobile Bay helped bring the U.S. Civil War to a close. Historians also credit the assault with helping Abraham Lincoln win a second term as president. In the next half hour, we'll look at the battle and Alabama's role in the Civil War in 1864. Stan Ingold will tell the story of the Mobile campaign from the perspective of the man who lost. Ryan Vasquez explains why Mobile Bay resulted in more Congressional Medals of Honor than any other U.S. naval battle. And Pat Duggins examines how Civil War history has become an expensive hobby which can get pretty loud. This is Damn the Torpedoes.
Hell yeah! Honor!
It's one of the best. I mean, it really, it's not quite as big as some of the others, but they do a really good job on the realism.
When it comes to Civil War reenactments, Terry Alley considers himself a connoisseur. The Rome, Georgia man is tromping along a muddy path in an open field on this rainy Saturday. His two sons are toting their iPhones today, but most of the people surrounding us aren't. Alley says that's the point.
I'm a history teacher, so I like the realism. I've taught about half the reenactors, too, so make sure they get it right. I always tell them, you better get it right, or I'm going to get you the next time I have you in class. So.
Right!
The rolling hills here are dotted by white canvas tents. Inside are men and women all in Civil War period costumes. The men are in military uniforms. Many of the ladies are wearing hoop skirts and bonnets. The whole scene is located just over the border between Alabama and Georgia, near a little town called Resaca.
The old legend was some of the ladies were so ugly they had to resack her.
That's Ken Paget. History teacher Terry Alley may train today's reenactors, but Paget bosses them around. He's the general in charge of this reenactment of the Battle of Resaca, which took place 150 years ago.
All over the country, we've got folks from California, Texas, Wisconsin, Ohio, and just nearly every state in the country is represented here, just as it was in the war.
Roughly 100 troops are forming an infantry line. They're all wearing the gray uniforms of the Confederacy. In another spot, other reenactors are in Union blue. They call them Federals here. These are the participants on two legs. Others have four.
Man with the beard, bring up Buddy.
Buddy is a dark red horse who will lead a team of six horses pulling a caisson. It's a wagon with a six-foot-long black cannon complete with ammunition.
A couple of our horses, this will be their first reenactment.
Steve Cameron of Blaine, Tennessee, is the captain of this artillery unit.
We've trained with them quite a bit, but this will be the first time they've actually been at a reenactment, so kind of interesting to see how that works out.
Attention! Battery! Five priests from the front! Forward and come up!
The reenactors don't use real bullets. Still, it's the shooting everybody comes for.
The most important thing is just kind of watch the whole battlefield.
Remember Terry Alley, the history teacher from Rome, Georgia? He and his family are about to head off to find a viewing spot on the rolling hills overlooking the battlefield.
So you see the horses, the messengers, you see the cannon, you see the riflemen and all that.
And Alley's favorite part?
I think the cannon. When the cannons start going off, it'll rattle your teeth.
With the battle reaching its height, General Ken Paget explains just what the reenactors are reenacting.
Well, the battle took place between Confederate General Joe Johnston and the Federal Army of William T. Sherman. The Confederate forces were heavily entrenched here at Resaca, and the Federal troops attacked those positions and suffered heavy casualties. They were around 5,500 casualties in a two-day period here.
One unit that took part in the actual Battle of Resaca was a ragtag group from Madison County called the 1st Alabama Cavalry. It's okay if you've never heard of them. Historians have.
You know, they did a lot, actually.
That's Dr. John Kovach. He teaches history at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, not far from where the 1st Alabama Cavalry was formed.
They served and they fought and they died and they sacrificed, just like every other unit that was fighting throughout the war.
But this is where the story gets a little complicated. During the presidential election of 1860, not everybody in Alabama liked slavery or the thought of the South breaking away from the Union. Kovach says that left the men of the 1st Alabama Cavalry in a bind on election day.
Their convictions pushed them to move toward supporting the Union by actually becoming a part of Union forces. They fought a number of skirmishes and major battles, in fact became a guard for General William T. Sherman.
Sherman is a bad word around, Alabama. He's not one of our favorites.
That's Sally Cox of Birmingham. She found out about the 1st Alabama Cavalry while researching her family tree.
And this is what I got. It's got all kinds of, letters.
Judging from the pile of documents on her dining room table, Cox has been keeping busy. She wanted to qualify to join the Daughters of the American Revolution. After a little digging, she found something a bit different. Namely, Captain Fernando Cortez Burdick of the 1st Alabama Cavalry. He went by Frank.
Great, great, I think it's two greats. Grandmother, yeah, it'd be great, great, great grandfather, right.
Cox considers herself an Alabamian, even though she was born in Tennessee. She does have relatives up north, and when word got out that one of her ancestors fought for the Union, well,
Nobody up there seems to think it's all that odd. Frankly, I do. This document says that he had to resign his commission because of some diseases contracted in the Army.
The one thing everyone seems to agree on is how the war pitted brother against brother. Remember Ken Paget, the general in charge of the reenactment of the Battle of Resaca? That hobby has turned him into an amateur historian. Paget says he's heard a lot of stories across the South, similar to the 1st Alabama Cavalry.
And you had relatives that was loyal to the Union, and then those that were rebellious and was loyal to the Confederacy. So it was not uncommon for soldiers on each side to run across some of their wounded relatives and stuff on the field.
There's a copy of the handwritten marriage license.
And that idea hits close to home for Sally Cox. There's a portrait that hangs on the wall of her dining room. It's a painting of two men, one in Union blue and the other in gray.
This is Fernando Cortez Burdick. This is Robert Alexander Hill. These are my great-great-grandparents.
And it should come as no surprise that while Burdick fought for the Union, Hill was for the Confederacy.
And the thing that was so interesting, I thought, was that they were both at the Battle of Shiloh. And we always joke in the family that great-great-grandpa Burdick shot great-great-grandparent Robert Alexander Hill, which of course is not, but it makes a great story.
Cox admits if he had, she wouldn't be here as their descendant. Burdick and Hill returned to Madison County after the war to form Cox's branch of the family tree. So it appears everything was resolved.
I consider myself Southern. I'm no Yankee.
Okay, not everything. I'm Pat Duggins in Birmingham.
And now my song is ended about those bloody plains. I hope the sight by mortal man may ne'er be seen again. But I pray to God my Savior, if consistent with thy will, to save the souls of all who fell on bloody Shadow Hill.
In Civil War history, you hear a lot about the battles. Afterwards, many of these soldiers wound up in prisoner of war camps, and APR's Stan Ingold visited the site of one of the biggest Confederate prisons near the town of Cahaba.
Jesus loves the little children, all the children of the world. Red and yellow.
This song is a Sunday school staple, but those weren't the original words.
Within the prison cell, we are waiting for the day that shall come. Open wide the iron door.
Songwriter George F. Root penned the tune Tramp, Tramp, Tramp in 1864, the year of the Battle of Mobile Bay. It was about a Union soldier writing his mother about life in a Confederate prison camp.
Tramp, 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 the boys are marching. Cheer up.
And that was a familiar song here. We're in a clearing near the center of the ghost town of Cahaba, Alabama. The Civil War prison camp called Castle Morgan stood here.
This is the wall that was originally meant to be a cotton warehouse, but was then converted into the prison for the captive federal soldiers.
Linda Derry is the site director at the park. We walk around the grounds of the prison that once held as many as 3,000 men at one time.
Now, we should move fast because if the guards would catch you here next to the wall, that's called the deadline, and they could shoot you dead. And there wasn't any marking, so you just had to remember not to get close to the wall. And several men reportedly were shot by the guards.
And it's guards and the prisoners that give the historians the most vivid details on life at Castle Morgan. Both captor and captive wrote letters home or kept journals.
I write this evening because I have nothing else to do, not because I have anything of importance to record.
Prisoner Melville Cox Robertson was a member of the 93rd Indiana Volunteer Infantry.
I have tried life in a good many ways, but prison life is rather the most monotonous thing yet. There is so little of congeniality of spirit among those with whom I am associated that I often feel myself almost completely alone in the midst of 500 men.
My dear brother and sister, it seems a long time since I heard from you or any of my connection. I am very anxious to hear from you all.
This monotony even carried over to the guards. Confederate soldier G.M. Wilson's job was to watch over men like Robertson.
I am still at Cahaba, the same place where you heard from me last. I have not heard from you since last spring. I want to know what has become of you all. I have not heard from home since I was at your house. I have wrote and wrote and never could get any answer.
Castle Morgan opened its gates in June of 1863. Despite the horror stories associated with POW camps, Park Director Linda Derry says Castle Morgan only lost around 144 captives.
When they went to parole at the end of the war, they were noticed for being the healthiest of all the prisoners because they were far from the front. There was food for them to eat. I mean, it wasn't anything great, but it was almost as good as what the Confederate soldiers were getting.
Along with the hardships of captivity, there were signs of normality, too.
I was walking on the principal residence street when two young ladies drove leisurely along in a single carriage.
Some of the men were even able to stroll around the town of Cahaba, like 1st Sergeant Charles Sombardo of the 12th Iowa.
In passing, I must have glanced at them, for they tossed a rose from the back of the carriage. I secured the flower and pressed it to my lips. They waved their pretty hands and drove away.
Many of the men held at Castle Morgan at the end of the war did not make it home. After surviving combat and for some years in a prison camp, Derry says another tragedy was waiting on their way home.
And what happened was they crowded them on this boat called the Sultana on the Mississippi, and somewhere right above Memphis, the boilers exploded and killed most of them. And most of those men were from here. It's considered the largest maritime disaster in U.S. history.
As far as my friends and people really knowing this information, very few of them do.
Julia Henson lives in Mobile. Her little secret is her family tree and the critical role it played in the history of the city and of the Battle of Mobile Bay in 1864.
Buchanan, of course, went to sea when he was like 15 years old.
There's a hint of pride as Henson talks about Franklin Buchanan. The Confederate admiral is Henson's great-great-grandfather.
Ended up being the first superintendent of the Naval Academy. He went to Japan with Perry when he opened Japan. And then he was head of the Washington Naval Yard at the time of the Civil War breaking out.
Henson's memories of Buchanan come from stories told by her parents and from the writings of Buchanan's daughter. She was Henson's great-grandmother. Her manuscript is sitting on Henson's lap. She reads how famous Buchanan was among the residents of Mobile, especially when he went to the theater.
Buchanan was given a private box for the season, draped with the admiral's flag. Every evening when we were not previously engaged, we went to the theater. Whenever my father entered his box, the audience applauded until he stood and bowed, and the band would play Dixie.
Of course, this was before the Battle of Mobile Bay. Things changed afterward because Admiral Buchanan was the man who lost. The sounds of cannons and muskets near the mouth of Mobile Bay are just ceremonial. It's all part of the show modern-day reenactors do for visitors at Fort Gaines. The scene was a lot different, though, in 1864, when Confederate and Union forces fought over Mobile Bay. Naval forces from the north were led by Admiral David Farragut, while the Confederate ships were commanded by Buchanan. A modern-day blacksmith demonstrates his craft for visitors at Fort Gaines. It was the smaller of the two forts at the entrance to Mobile Bay. On the other side was Fort Morgan.
Fort Morgan was the major post because the main ship channel running into Mobile Bay ran directly under the guns of Fort Morgan.
Mike Bailey is the site director of the fort.
It was turned over to the Confederacy in March 1861 from the state of Alabama and served as a fort to guard the entrance to Mobile Bay for blockade runners who were trying to bring necessary supplies into Mobile.
Bailey says the forts were just the first obstacle Farragut and Union forces encountered.
Confederates, to bolster their defenses, planted torpedoes and obstructions and built up a four-ship Confederate naval force, which was centered around the CSS Tennessee, which was one of the most powerful ironclads the Confederate Navy ever constructed.
These torpedoes inspired the now infamous line delivered by Admiral Farragut, "Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead." However, there's a problem with that line.
It's not David Farragut that said, "Damn the torpedoes," but Tunis Craven, who is the commanding officer of the Tecumseh.
Bailey says Craven disobeyed orders to go into the field.
The pilot, John Collins, who is relating the story in this newspaper article, says that he tells Craven, "You're going into the torpedo field." And Craven says, "Damn the torpedoes, I want that fellow, take me alongside." And he's talking about the Tennessee.
Craven's ship soon struck a mine, ripping a hole in the ironclad. It sank in just 3 minutes, taking Craven and 93 members of the crew to the bottom of the bay. A buoy near Fort Morgan marks the final resting place of the Tecumseh and the men who went down with the ship.
After being wounded during the Battle of Mobile Bay, he was taken prisoner and eventually shipped to New York.
Julia Henson prefers the good stories about her famous ancestor. In this account from her great-grandmother, Henson says Buchanan's fame in Mobile held up even after his defeat.
"After the war, when my poor father was left without his profession and penniless, his kind friends there gave him a position in the Mutual Insurance Company, which he accepted until he was offered the position of president of the Agricultural College in Blandenburg, Maryland."
The ladies in Mobile, they all raised a doleful cry, and loudly for vengeance every one of them bawled. For they'd lost the price of their dresses and finery when their darling was taken at Farragut's ball.
Along with being a decisive battle in the Civil War, the campaign at Mobile Bay attracted a lot of attention from newspapers of the day. Pat Duggins explains more stories didn't mean faster coverage.
Before radio, television, and the internet, this is how most people got their headlines. We're in the press room of the Birmingham News. The edition you hear on the presses now will wind up on doorsteps in a few hours. Back in 1864, the earliest news on the Battle of Mobile Bay took 6 days to get out.
The Daily Ohio Statesman, August 17th, 1864.
we have our first installment of the glorious news from Admiral Farragut's Victoria Squadron. The reports furnished are full of the most intense interest, and this latest achievement of the old Salamander will place him at the top of the list of all naval commanders of the world.
One source I read said that it was the naval equivalent of Pickett's Charge at Gettysburg.
Dr. Deborah Van Tool teaches history at Georgia Regents University in Augusta.
That would say to me that writer thought that this was indeed a turning point.
Van Tool's specialty is Civil War journalism and how it worked. The Battle of Mobile Bay appears to have been hot news in 1864. Just how hot?
It ran on page one, which is sort of an innovation of newspapers in this period. Prior to the Civil War, page one was all advertising, usually, and news actually ran on page two. But during the war, people wanted news so quickly, newspaper editors realized that they needed to start putting news on the front page.
Chattanooga Rebel, August 26, 1864. The Yankees say Fort Morgan capitulated at 2 o'clock on Tuesday last. On Monday evening, they concentrated their fire on the fort, which replied sharply. On Tuesday, the bombardment was renewed.
Papers ranging from the New York Times to the Chattanooga Rebel sent reporters or collected eyewitness accounts on the battle between Admiral David Farragut of the Union and Admiral Franklin Buchanan of the Confederacy. This is where historians start to differ on the value of news accounts.
Newspapers are not necessarily the first place you'd go to find out exactly what happened.
That's Dr. Craig Simons. He taught for 30 years at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. Simons also wrote over 30 books on American military history. His criticism focuses on how, in the 1860s, newspapers took sides.
So there were Republican newspapers and there were Democratic newspapers, and the Republican newspapers would generally say something like, "What a tremendous victory this is to substantiate our great president's war policy." And Democratic papers would say, "Well, yes, we won this one, but the costs were very heavy, and that proves the policy is not working, and we should throw this rascal out of office."
And that was just in the North, and the rascal Simons is talking about was Republican President Abraham Lincoln.
You did certainly have the majority of Northern papers who were yay Union, and the majority of Southern newspapers who were yay Confederacy.
That's Deborah Van Tool. She says Southern papers appeared even more critical of their president, Jefferson Davis.
Well, they used words like despot and even some nastier things to describe him. And in fact, the Augusta Chronicle and Sentinel made the comment once, if they had to have a despot ruling the country, they might as well just go back into the Union and have Abraham Lincoln.
Richmond Inquirer, August 15th, 1864. Fort Gaines has done the way of Hatteras, Roanoke Island, Pulaski, and Hilton Head. Its isolated position was exposed to the concentrated assault of the Yankee Navy. Perhaps the officer in command of the fort may have proven himself a traitor. In that case, eternal infamy awaits him.
If there's one thing the news coverage didn't resolve, it's what Craig Simon says was the Holy Grail connected to the Battle of Mobile Bay. It's one of the famous sayings he used to hear around the campus during his teaching days at Annapolis.
Famous phrases like, "Don't give up the ship, we have met the enemy and they are ours," those kinds of things, and along with them is, "Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead."
As catchy as David Farragut's statement might have been, Simons contends a Navy man wouldn't have said it like that.
Another theory is that he simply said, "Go on, go ahead, four bells." But that doesn't have quite the dramatic ring of "damn the torpedoes." So instead of saying "full speed ahead," which a landlubber might say, he would have used the naval term "four bells."
And apparently no newspaper account says who's right and who's wrong.
Sergeant Pitt's courage, steadfast commitment to the defense of his unit, and ability to fight while seriously wounded prevented the enemy from overrunning the observation post and capturing fallen American soldiers.
I'm Ryan Vasquez in Tuscaloosa. Staff Sergeant Ryan Pitts is the most recent recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor. The honor is awarded to military personnel for personal acts of valor above and beyond the call of duty. Pitt joins an exclusive fraternity. Just over 3,000 soldiers out of the millions of U.S. servicemen and women are awarded the Medal of Honor. It also connects soldiers today to some of the first recipients of the award following the Battle of Mobile Bay.
John Lawson is serving in the shell whip. It's the area where they're bringing powder and shells up from the storage lockers up to the guns.
Ken Johnston is the executive director of the National Civil War Naval Museum in Columbus, Georgia.
and an incoming shot goes off in that confined space. He's stunned, knocked unconscious, wounded. There are dead men on top of him, you know, these smoldering fragments, choking smoke. He gets up and continues passing the much-needed ammunition and gunpowder up and goes about his job.
For this action during the Battle of Mobile Bay, John Lawson received the Medal of Honor. Lawson and 114 men received the U.S. military's highest honor for Mobile Bay, which makes it second only to the Battle of Vicksburg for the most decorated battle in U.S. history.
And now we're below decks. We're on the berth deck of the Hartford.
Ken Johnston takes us through a replica of the USS Hartford. The original was Farragut's flagship during the capture of New Orleans and the Battle of Mobile Bay.
It's accurate down to the details of, you know, the rat sitting on top of the gun rack over there, the guy eating his dinner just on the floor there with a piece of canvas for his tablecloth. Even when you're not in battle, you just say you're anchored. The ship is always moving.
Farragut would steer the Hartford and the rest of his fleet into Mobile Bay for a clash with Confederate forces on August 5th. During this modern-day reenactment at Fort Morgan National Park, Confederate soldiers in full costume fired blanks at ships off the Alabama coast while the vessel shot back. Fort Morgan historian Mike Bailey says the real battle was the fight of David Farragut's life.
David Farragut himself said that it was the hardest battle he was ever involved in. And that's saying a whole lot because he was involved in fighting on the Mississippi River, intense fighting there. But just the nature of the fighting, it's the largest naval battle that was during the Civil War, and just the intensity.
So we have a strategically important port that, if taken, could cripple the Confederacy, and intense fighting between Union and Confederate forces in the war's largest naval battle. Any other explanations?
One of the reasons so many of them are being awarded in the Civil War, it's the only medal the Navy has.
John Beeler teaches history at the University of Alabama.
There are Navy stars and other forms of commendation for conspicuous bravery above and beyond the call of duty, which don't quite rise to the level of the Congressional Medal of Honor. There are plenty of those now, but there's nothing else in the Civil War, so it becomes this sort of all-or-nothing mentality.
Mike Bailey says that may explain how John Smith won his Medal of Honor with nothing more than a rock.
A Confederate sailor looked up through the gun port of the Tennessee and looked at Commander Marchant, who is the commanding officer of the Lackawanna, and yelled, "You Yankee so-and-so." And John Smith, hearing that, ran to his commanding officer's aid, took a holy stone, and threw it through the gun port of the Tennessee and hit the Confederate with it, and he was awarded the Medal of Honor for that.
Soldiers that were here who had been at Vicksburg said they had never seen anything like a bombardment like this on one point. Now, we come today to recognize them, and for the first time, we will have a monument here. So everyone, all visitors will come and be able to recognize the sacrifice and what these men did as they fought here.
Tom Halliday, Billy Field, Andrew Livingston, Chuck Meraz, Trip Watts, and Matthew Rand read our Civil War newspaper articles and letters. Also, APR offers special thanks to musician Bobby Horton. I'm Jeremy Loeb. For Pat Duggins, Ryan Vasquez, Stan Ingold, and everyone at Alabama Public Radio, thanks for tuning in, and good night.